And talk about open hands, some of the things that God is doing through the ministry of open hands. I have to push my button here. There, did that work, Leroy? Am I on? All right. So this afternoon I want to talk to you about some of the things that God's doing through open hands. Open hands provides Christ-centered economic development opportunities for the poor through savings-led microfinance programs. Our purpose is for that, and having Christ-centered economic development programs is very important. The fact that it's centered on Christ is a central part of it, because just helping the poor to have more material wealth really isn't the answer. It has to be focused, and you'll understand as we go through the presentation a little more why the fact that it's Christ-centered is really a central part of our program. Our mission is that as Anabaptist followers of Christ, we desire to keep the commands of Scripture to bear one another's burdens and to consider the cause of the poor through the development of self-supporting micro-lending, micro-enterprise programs, and teach biblical financial concepts, present the gospel of Christ for a witness to the nations. So that's our mission statement. Our theme verse is from Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 7 and 8. When we went to Kenya, one of the things that we always have a challenge when we present our program to national people is they listen to what we do and they say, well, that's good, but you should give us something. Like, you're a mission and missions give things. And so, yeah, we could do what you're saying, but it'd be better if you would give us something. And so when we were in Kenya, we had a long discussion with the one group about why we don't give anything away and all that. And then one of the men said to me, can I ask you a question? Sure. He said, we were invited to a meeting about finances with an American organization named Open Hands, and we just assumed that you were going to come with open hands. And now you're telling us that you're never going to give us anything. So how did you get your name if you don't have open hands when you come? And I said, well, you have to look at our verse. Our name comes from Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 7 and 8. It says, if there's any poor person among you, you should open your hands to them and give them, lend to them what they need. And we know that you have poor people in your churches, and you want to help them, but you can't because you don't have the financial management and the resources you need to help the poor people in your church. So we're going to help you to get to the place where you will have in your hands what you need to open your hand to the poor that are in your churches and be able to help them. And he said, oh, so it's our hands that are open. I said, exactly. So I'm saying, they're your poor people, right? So why should somebody come from America and help your poor people when they're the poor people in your churches? As a church, you should be helping the poor people. And we know you want to do that, so we're going to help you to be able to do that. Say, okay, we can do that. That'll work. And so people begin to pick up the vision for what they can do themselves rather than somebody else coming and doing it, an outsider coming into the community. I'd like to talk to you a little bit this afternoon about what poverty is, what causes poverty, because what we think causes poverty determines how we try to bring solutions to poverty. So we have to think about what poverty is. Poverty, Bryant Meyer says in his book, Walking with the Poor, I really like this definition of poverty. He says, poverty is the result of relationships that do not work, that are not just, that are not for life, that are not harmonious or enjoyable. Poverty is the absence of shalom and all its meanings. So poverty is more than people just not having financial resources. It really comes from relationships. It's a result of sin. When you look at the Garden of Eden, there wasn't poverty in the Garden of Eden. They had enough to eat. They had everything they needed. They were in a good environment. Nature was harmonious. All those things were working. But as a result of sin, a number of relationships were broken. The first relationship that was broken was their relationship with God. And they no longer could fellowship with God in the cool of the day as they used to before that. So the relationship with God was broken. Their relationship with themselves was broken because they went into hiding. And before that, they never had any need to hide when God came. And so they saw themselves as sinners, and they began to realize there's something broken inside of us, and we are not the way we ought to be. Thirdly, their relationship with each other was broken. Because when God started talking to them about what they had done, they started to blame each other. Adam said, well, this woman you gave me, he's really saying to God, it's your fault, but because you made her, and then she told me to do it, and so she got it. And then the woman says, well, it was the serpent. And so blame shifting and problems in relationships. I don't think Adam and Eve had marriage problems before the fall. And so relationship problems came into the world as a result of sin. And then, of course, the challenges with nature and the fact that now it's difficult to have nature produce the food and the things that we need. And there's storms and natural disasters and those kinds of things that we deal with today. So we teach that there are four fundamental relationships that are broken as a result of sin. And those four broken relationships are what cause poverty. When you think about what brings poverty, poverty is often the result of broken relationships with people, people that are abusive to other people, people's wrong relationship with God. People are not living in the way they ought to live. They're not making wise choices. And these broken relationships. So we work on reconciliation with God, reconciliation with other people, reconciliation with dealing with ourselves and with nature. And then the result of that is the alleviation of poverty. So we're not looking at, okay, our end goal here is that you will all have more money. Our end goal is that you will be able to fix relationships in your community, your relationship with God, your relationship with others, and the church becomes central to that being done, because the way that relationships are restored and the way we experience reconciliation is through being in fellowship with each other in the church and there finding fellowship with each other and with God. And so having the church and Christ at the center of the program then allows for reconciliation of relationships, and out of that comes a different way of using finances and a different result. The alleviation of poverty is a side benefit of a larger issue, a larger reconciliation that's happening in people's lives. I was talking to a man who works for one of the large Christian microfinance organizations, and he was telling me that when he first started his career in microfinance, he was in Rwanda, and he said that there he met a man who was living in poverty. He was at his house was in poor shape, and his children weren't able to go to school all the time and that kind of thing. And so he helped him to start a business so that he could increase his income. And the man, he helped him to get a loan. The microfinance organization he worked for gave him a loan so he could start a business. He started a business. In a year's time, he tripled his income. So this aid worker went back a year later, met this same man, and went to his house, and he thought, well, I'm going to see a lot of changes here. Like, his income has tripled, so he's going to have fixed up his house. His children will be going to school. All those things will be happening. Well, he said when he got to his house, it looked the same, and his children still weren't going to school. And he said when he asked him what's happening with the money, he found out that his increased income was going to alcohol and prostitutes. So he hadn't changed anything. He had more income, but it didn't benefit his family and his lifestyle at all. So if we help people to have more money without reconciliation with Christ and their relationships with others, it really is kind of pointless, and it's not what we want to do at all. Well, we think about what hasn't worked. Some of the things that haven't worked are long-term direct aid, where we just hand out aid continually over decades. The transferring of money from the rich to the poor, the government on a large scale taxing the rich and giving it to the poor, redistribution of wealth doesn't solve poverty in the long term. The depletion of natural resources, where people through mining or other use of natural resources that where they have temporary wealth, but when the resources are gone, it's gone, hasn't worked in the long term. And blaming poverty on outside factors or forces hasn't worked either, but taking responsibility for ourselves and what we're experiencing in life is different. So what has worked is that the concept that earned success is more important than money. The fact that what I have and what I have done has resulted in what I have. That I have success, and that success didn't come from a handout from somebody. It didn't come from somebody giving me something. It didn't come from me being fortunate in some way, but it's a result of what I've done, and that I've done this myself, and we've done it ourselves without outside aid. One of the things that's really encouraging to me is when we go into places where we have savings groups now, and we're in situations where people have received aid for decades, and they're used to things happening because somebody else does it. And they, when people have lived in poverty for several generations, they tend to develop a mindset, my situation is hopeless, and I'm helpless to do anything about it. So unless somebody comes and does something for me, I'm stuck. And that's true in underdeveloped countries. It's true in intercity welfare communities here in the United States and Canada, where after a few decades, people really feel like they're incapable of changing their situation. And so either the government or an aid agency or somebody has to come and do something for them because they're poor and they can't do it themselves. The power of what we do is that people get a glimpse of what they can do with their own resources. And then when people realize what they can do with their own resources, all of a sudden they realize that our future and what our lives are going to be like and what our children's lives are going to be like probably has more to do with how we manage our resources and what we do and the choices we make than it does with an outside agency coming in and bringing change into our communities. When I was in Kenya, and we did our presentation there at lunchtime, one of the Kenyan men was sitting beside me, and he said, "Merle, I understand what you're saying, but you have to recognize that when you're talking to the people in our churches here in Kenya, you are not talking to a cross-section of Kenyan society. You are talking to people, some of whom have chosen to be a part of the church because they want to have the ability to rely on somebody else to provide their livelihood." And so he said, "You're presenting a concept here, but some of these people are not going to do it because they already looked at that and said they're not going there." And he said, "We have people in our churches here. They know exactly how much they can earn in a year and stay on the widow support program. And they're not going to cross that line because they don't want to lose what they get through the widow support program." But he said, when they do that, what they're forgetting two things. One thing they're forgetting is that this year, if they would cross that line and they'd lose the widow's support, they might be worse off than they would have been if they stayed on the widow's support program. But 3 years from now, they may be able to be way better off than they would be if they just stay on the widow's support program. But they don't look at that. He said the other thing they're not thinking about is their children are watching them, and their children are learning that when you become an adult, what you do is you find out how you can qualify for somebody's aid program, and then you get on that aid program and make sure you don't get off. And I said, I know that's true, and I understand that. But I said, I know there are people in the churches that they're not there, and they are going to say, I want to do that, and things can change. And then there are some people who don't know. They're kind of nervous, and they don't really... they're not sure if they should or not, but they're going to watch the people who do it, and they're going to see what those people do, and then they're going to say, hey, if they did it, I can do it too, and they'll do it. And then there'll be some people who will just say, no, I'm never doing that. I'm going to stay on whatever aid I can get, and I'm not changing, and that's okay. You can't do much for those people anyway. But there are people who will change, and that's what I get really excited about when I see people taking those steps. People that... I was in a savings group in Haiti probably 2.5 years ago or so, and there was a man that's in that savings group that I've known for 25 years. And I know that many times I would be in his house and he'd talk to me about things he needs and so on. And I just know that, I'm getting ahead of my story here, but we're sitting in the savings group and he said, Pastor Merle, we have some ideas for our savings group. Now he said, these aren't ideas for this year or next year. These are ideas for 10 years from now, 15 years from now. And we'd like to know what you think about our ideas. So I said, well, what are your ideas? He said, we'd like to know if you think we can do it. I said, well, tell me. And he said, well, what we'd like to do is we don't want our savings group just to benefit the people in our group. And you see, one of the things that we do right up front in the groups, every group writes policies before they ever start saving any money. They write goals for their group. What's it going to look like if this group is successful? And one of the things we start encouraging them right in the beginning is success is not everybody in our group is going to have more money. Success is we're going to be able to give more. That our church offerings are going to go up. We're going to be able to help other people in our community. So he was saying, we want our savings group to benefit everybody in our community. And so we're thinking about how that could happen. So he said, what we're thinking about is we're wondering, maybe 10 years from now, 15 years from now, we would be able to have enough money that we could buy a tractor and somebody could operate that tractor for the group, and we could do commercial plowing for people in the community, and we could raise the agricultural output of the whole community. And maybe we could loan somebody money to buy a grinding mill, and they could grind grain right here in our community so that people don't have to pay to haul their grain somewhere else and get it ground and then have it hauled back. And it would provide a couple of jobs in our community. And those are some of the ideas we have. We don't want to know what you think. Well, that particular savings group, in a year's time, had saved the equivalent of $3,000 U.S., and so I told them, of course you can do it. Think about it. You've saved $3,000 U.S. in 1 year. If you do that for 10 years, you're going to have $30,000 in your loan pool. Yes, you can buy a tractor or you can buy a grinding mill. That is possible. You can do that. What excited me about that is that I know that that man was the kind of person who, without a savings group, I would have been at his house and he would have said to me, Pastor Merle, if you would just get us money to get a tractor, then somebody could do commercial plowing and we could raise the agricultural output here and we'd pay you back and all that. He would have had a big plan of how it's all going to work and all that. But it would have all been dependent on me finding him money to buy a tractor. And if I would have done that, I can almost guess that 2 years later, that tractor would have been broken and they would have said, Pastor Merle, your tractor's broken and we need money to fix the tractor. So if it's my money that's at risk, if it's our money that's at risk, that's a whole different story than if it's their money that's at risk. So if they save the money and they buy the tractor, they're going to make sure it's running. And if it breaks, it's not going to be my responsibility to fix the tractor. So that's just, and it's just a whole shift in mentality. So when you take a person who has seen themselves as a recipient of charity, and they see themselves, their life is not going to change unless somebody gives them something, and you take that person and you turn them around and to where they see themselves as a giver, and they see themselves as being a person who gives charity and helps others, that's really transformational in the way people see themselves and how they think change is going to come into their community and just what they're willing to do for themselves. I was in Haiti probably a year and a half ago, and we were at the convention, and they raise money for their own convention. They feed like 700 people for the weekend, and they buy a cow and kill it, and they buy chicken, and they spend a lot of money on their convention. It's a big celebration, a huge event, and they take offerings, and they raise the money to do that. And I was walking with the pastor, and there is a widow lady in that community who was living in Port-au-Prince with her husband and her two sons. Her husband died, and they were in debt, and her husband's creditors came, put her out of the house they were renting, took all the furniture and sold it, and she basically had nothing. And her landlord put her out of the house because he knew she wasn't going to be able to pay the rent now that her husband died. She had a sister who lived out in the country where we're doing the savings group program. She came out. She was living in her sister's kitchen. It was rainy season. She was in the mud. And Pastor Paul, the Haitian pastor there, found her in that kitchen, and he helped her to get into a house that he had nobody was living in at the time, and she moved into that house, and she began to work, and she started a small business, and she was able to get some income. She paid off her debts in the city. She was able to improve her house. Her son was able to get a sewing machine, and he was able to start working as a tailor, and between them, they were able to produce an income for their family. After we started the savings group program 4 years ago, she got into a savings group, which helped her then also to grow her business. And anyway, that's her story. And as I was walking with the pastor outside the church one day and during the convention, and we were talking about the offerings and how they're doing with getting money together for the convention, and he said, Pastor Merle, do you know who is the second largest donor in our church? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, it's that widow lady. And I just think that's phenomenal when you take a widow lady who had nothing, and over a period of years, she faithfully deals with what she has in her hands, and she takes it and has a focus on generosity and giving to others. Anyway, earned success is more important than money. And people having the sense, when I get into savings groups, people are very eager to say, look at what we've done. This is what we did. So you start asking questions. How much money do you have in your loan pool? What have you done with what you saved? And they just really like to talk about what they did, because there's that sense, there's dignity in work, and there's dignity in doing things, providing for your family, and caring for the needs of your family, and then being able to give. That brings dignity. And so it's people just enjoy talking about that, helping people to help themselves, to help them to recognize that they can do it and they're not helpless and their situation isn't hopeless, giving people tools that they need to make progress. When we did our presentation in Kenya, one of the men was saying, you're saying that you're never going to give us anything. You're not going to give us anything now, not next year, not 5 years from now, not 10 years from now. You're never going to give us anything. And one of the older men stood up in the back and he said to me, you say that you are a teacher who comes to teach from Jesus, but you're not. Because Jesus said, give to the person that asks of you, and from him that would borrow, don't turn away. And if you were really teaching what Jesus taught, you would give us something, and you're saying you're not going to, so you can't be teaching what Jesus taught. I said, well, I understand what you're saying, but you're forgetting one thing, and that is, when the disciples were together with Jesus, and they had, well, there was 5,000 people there who were hungry, and the disciples said to Jesus, you better send them away because they really need something to eat. Jesus said, well, you give them something to eat. And they said, you want us to spend that much money on food? Like, what shall we do? And he said, well, what do you have? And they said, well, we have 5 loaves and 2 fish, but what's that among so many people? And so we can't really do it. And he said, well, give it to me. And they gave it to him, and he blessed it, and they spread it. Everybody ate, and there was lots left over. And I was saying, you know, Jesus could have said, when they said, well, all we have is, you know, Jesus could have said, yeah, you know what, those 5 loaves and 2 fish, that really is, you really don't have anything. You don't have enough to do anything. So I better really help you out. So poof, I'm going to create 10 truckloads of bread for you. Just a miracle here, and you'll see what I can do. He didn't do that at all. He started with what they had, and then he blessed it, and it became enough. And so if we start with what we have, and we're faithful with that, the Bible says the person who's faithful with little is faithful with a lot. And so we prove our faithfulness with a little. Well, then one of the men said, all right, listen. He said, these people came. They told us they're never going to give us anything. He said, I want to tell you something about us as Kenyans. He said, here's what we do. He said, we're like Jacob and Esau. And he said, you know, Esau came in from the field, and he wanted soup. And Jacob had soup. And he said to Jacob, give me that soup or I'm going to die. And he thought that the answer to his problem was Jacob's soup. Jacob gave him the soup in exchange for his birthright, and he had bigger problems after he had the soup than he did before he had the soup. And so the gift of the soup came with strings attached, and he was worse off than he was before. He'd have been better off to say, no, thank you, I'll make my own soup and do that. And he's saying, we've been doing that for too many years. We've been looking for quick solutions to our problems, and we find quick solutions to our problems, and then we find out that we have bigger problems than we did before. And he said, it's about time we start cooking our own soup. And so he said, we better do what these guys are telling us to do. They're telling us they're never going to give us any soup, but they're going to come and teach us how to cook soup. So let's learn how to cook soup, and then we'll have our own soup, and we won't have the problems that go along with somebody else giving us their soup. So all right, that's great. There's a man that has the right philosophy, and that's what we need. And then working to bring restoration in relationships and true shalom to a community where relationships work. And many things we've seen in underdeveloped countries is that when things go wrong, people are very quick to, there's a big blow up and people say, well, that's it, I'm never having anything to do with that again. And there's a break in relationships and it doesn't get restored. And one of the things that we do is that if there's a problem in a savings group, we help people to get together and say, you know, this problem doesn't have to break up the group. You can solve that. You can talk about it. You can work through it. Let's solve this problem. So we had a savings group in Haiti where I'm not quite sure what happened, how it happened, but they loaned way too much of their money to one person. They loaned like 60% of their loan pool to one person, which they should never do. And he said that he was gonna do one thing with it. And instead of doing what he told the savings group he was going to do with it, he went and bought some cows. And people were really angry. And they were like, those cows are going to die. We're going to lose our money. And that isn't what he said he was going to do. And so people were angry. And I'm out. I'm never being part of this savings group again. And they were gone. So our Haitian employees had to get them together and say, no, that's not right. Let's sit down and talk about it, talk all the way through it. And they say, this guy who bought the cows, you know, that isn't what you said you were going to do. And you shouldn't have done that. And so he agreed to sell the cows and give the money back. And so they solved it all, and the group went on. And there's something about learning to work through challenges and deal with relationships where, I don't know, there's education and learning there as well. Well, who is Open Hands? We're associated with Anabaptist Financial, as Marvin said. And Anabaptist Financial is an organization that offers financial and foundation services to Anabaptist people in the United States. We operate under that board. And Anabaptist Financial is also concerned about Anabaptist people in the third world, or the underdeveloped world, the underdeveloped countries that don't have access to financial services. We put a lot of time and energy into providing financial services for relatively wealthy North American Anabaptist people who have access to banking services and those kinds of things already. But we have to recognize that the Anabaptist Brotherhood extends beyond the borders of the United States or Canada. And we have Anabaptist brothers and sisters in underdeveloped countries that don't have access to banking services and who are struggling in their daily lives. And Anabaptist Financial also wants to have a ministry to the Anabaptist community beyond the borders of the United States. Open Hands is managed by a committee of interested brothers. We're under the authority of the AF board, but then there's a management committee that takes care of the management of the program, because the board doesn't want to deal with all the issues that come up in Open Hands. So these are the men that are on the Open Hands management committee. What we do, we operate savings and credit associations in underdeveloped countries where Anabaptist churches are present. We don't go to places. We want to be an assisting arm of the Anabaptist churches in underdeveloped countries. So we are not going into countries where Anabaptist churches or their Anabaptist missions are not working. We will serve other people in those countries, people who aren't Anabaptist. As Marvin was saying, we have people in savings groups that aren't even believers. So we're not limiting our services to Anabaptist people or to believers. But we want to operate in places where Anabaptist believers can participate in the programs and the Anabaptist churches can benefit from the program. We don't do microloans. We never loan out any of our own money. All of the money that's loaned out in the program is the money that the people save themselves. We never put any money into any of the savings groups. The loan pools that they have are all their own money. I had a businessman with me one time in Haiti, and we were visiting a savings group, and he said, you know, Merle, like, this is really working. Like, these people are doing a good job. They're really faithful, and they've been saving for over a year, and look at what they have. But it really isn't very much. He was saying, couldn't I put $5,000 into that savings group just to help them have more money? I said, yeah, you could, and you'd kill it, because they'd kind of look at that and say, well, you know, maybe next year he'll put another $5,000 in. And so it would destroy something that's very foundational to the to what we do. And I believe in micro lending. There's a place for that, and I'm not against that. For us, I'm just saying that the savings model, I believe, has a powerful effect that micro lending doesn't always have. We offer a hand up, not a handout, teaching them to save their own money in order to purchase the things that that they need. We hire and train national people to run the program. We don't want this to be an outside program that when we come to a savings group that people say, yeah, we run the Open Hands program and it's really a good program and you guys have a good program. We want to be able to come into the groups and they say, "This, look at what we did. We started this savings group and this is what we've done." And so we're almost observers. Now, we do want to have one North American person in the country, who is in the country most of the time or part of the time, who helps with reporting and accountability and those kinds of things, but doesn't really have any authority in the savings group. We try and push the decision-making down as far as we can so that the people in the groups are making the decisions, not a foreigner who's in the country, or certainly not us who are out of the country. We want the group, so every group has their own executive. They have a president, a vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer, and they are self-directing, and we give them, we have influence in the groups, but we don't have control over the groups. And so we in Haiti, we have seven Haitian employees that run the program there. We train them, and they operate the program. In India, we have about 10 Indian people who are trained and who are running the program there. In Kenya, we have two Kenyan men who are operating the program in Kenya. And that's where Joe comes in, because Joe and Marilyn will be, the last half of this year, will be living in Haiti, and he will be the program liaison person there, so he'll be helping with reporting and accountability in the program. And then at the end of this year, we're hoping that we can place them in India and have them provide that same kind of reporting and accountability for the programs in India. And we're looking at, having Joe, our ideal is, and we'll see how this works out, but our ideal is to have Joe and Marilyn based in India and be responsible for programs in Asia and Africa, and have someone else in Haiti and be responsible for programs in Haiti and Central and South America. So that's kind of how we're looking at the divide. But Haiti is our oldest program and the most established, so we're starting Joe's there for 6 months to get them some experience and in an established program, and then they can take that and transfer that to India and work out of, we're not sure yet if they're going to be based in India or Kenya, but one or the other, and they will be responsible for those programs then. Our objective is to assist the local church by helping people to grow in Christ, teaching them to save funds in order to operate micro-businesses. I think that the savings group program will increase their income and result in stronger, more self-sufficient churches. One of the things that I saw when I lived in Haiti for a year, 25 years ago, was that you will never have a self-supporting, totally indigenous church if 70% of the people are unemployed. They just don't have the economic base to do it. They are always going to be dependent on an outside organization. And so if we can help the churches to have the economic base so that they can be self-supporting and they can be truly indigenous churches and they can carry the weight of their own programs, that's foundational. But often when you have a church planting mission and you have somebody who's doing spiritual ministry, if that same person tries to do the financial piece, it gets confusing. Because then people start, why is this person here? Are they here to loan me money? Or are they here to shepherd me spiritually? And then if a church planting missionary starts a business and becomes the employer, that gets even more complicated. And so what we want to do is come in as a financial organization, say we have nothing to do with the church. We're not going to tell you how to do church or spiritual discipleship. That's not our role. But we are here. We're here to do the financial piece and teach about finances and having a right relationship with Christ. And that's our focus, and that's what we do. And then the church planting missionaries can say to the national people, these are the people to talk to about money. These are the people to talk to about finances. They'll help you with that. We're here to help you with the church. And we feel like it fits and it works together. And we don't have any statistics because the churches in Haiti don't keep detailed accounting records of their offerings and church attendance and those kinds of things. But the pastors are saying that church offerings have gone up and church attendance has gone up in the places where there have been savings groups. One large Christian microfinance organization that does savings groups in Africa, they're working in Rwanda with the Anglican Church. And there, the Anglican Church does keep detailed records. And they said, after a five-year period of having savings groups in the Anglican diocese in Rwanda, they have tracked offerings and church attendance. Their church offerings have gone up 65%, and their church attendance has gone up 35%. And we think the results in Haiti are probably fairly similar to that in what's happening in Haiti. But we don't have any way of officially measuring it. Through savings groups, people in poverty gain the confidence needed to bring about change in their own lives and their community, the satisfaction of doing things without outside help. And change doesn't, we've talked about a lot of this. One pastor said in Haiti said that when the groups first started, people thought they'd join a group because maybe someday somebody would give them something. But he said actually the opposite happened. As people got into savings groups, they were able to give more and their church offerings have gone up. We do three types of savings groups. Our first type of savings group is a direct savings. People save for specific things. And usually our groups have a six-month savings cycle. If they start in the 1st of July, then they save every week. The groups meet once a week. They save every week. And then at the end of December, everybody gets their money back. So I was in a group about a year ago, a year and a half ago. There were 14 women in that group. They had all started saving in April for their children's school tuition in September. And in Haiti, children's school tuition is a big crisis for many families. And so these 14 women had started in April. They each knew how many children they had. They knew what it was going to cost to send them to school. They started saving in April. I was there at the end of August, and I saw the amount of money they were putting on the table, and I just asked them, like, how are you ladies doing? Like, are you getting close? And they're like, they just smiled, and they said, yeah, we're all going to be able to send all our children to school for the whole school year. We have the money. And so, well, have you ever been able to do that before? And they said, no, never. And we never knew at this point of the year that we'd have the money to send our children to school. So there's one crisis that those families, those 14 families, are not going to have that year because they save. And one of the things about save meeting every week is that it really gets the amount they need to save on a weekly basis down to a small amount that's doable, and they can do that. Every person has a savings objective, and they basically don't get any interest on it. They just save it. One of the things that's a real benefit is that if you're saving 25 cents a week or a dollar a week, you're not gonna go to the bank to put that money in the bank. And some of these people, like this particular savings group here, is in a church that is probably maybe almost 3 hours from a bank. So you're not going to be banking. But if you have a group at the church that you can walk to and you can put your money there, then it's a tremendous service because people can save their money right at the church. And the pastor of this particular church, Pastor Milo, I was talking to him back in March when I was there. And I was asking him, so these savings groups in his area just started in 2013. So I was asking him, how do you see the savings groups in your area? Like, how do you see it impacting your area? He said, well, it's really good. He said, in our church, it's great. And he said, for me personally, too, it's a really good thing. Because I tried to save money at my house before we had savings groups, but I couldn't. He said, when I'd have money in my house, it would always be talking to me, and it would always be saying, spend me, and then I would. And he said, now I take it to the church, I put it in the savings group, it doesn't talk to me anymore. And so then at the end of 6 months, I get it back, and I can do things that I would have never been able to do if I tried to save it in my house. And so that's one of the benefits of the direct savings groups. Here's a savings group. This group in Haiti had, at this meeting, this particular meeting, they were dividing up the money that they had saved over the past 6 months. There were 69 members of this group. We really have been telling them, you need to divide. But the problem is, they really like the president of the group, and they really trust their treasurer. And they can't think of anybody else in the group that they would trust with the money, so they don't want to divide. So now, I was there at this meeting, and they had 69 members. They reorganized, and now they have 90-some members. And it takes them forever to save money. Like, people bring books along to the meetings, because if everybody's saving money and you have 90 people and everybody has to come up to the table and give their deposit, it takes a long time. And so anyway, but these 69 people, in the 6 months before this meeting, they had saved the equivalent of a little over $6,000 US. And in addition, and what they had done as well, they were passing out the money and everybody got their envelope with their money in, and then they had one envelope, because every week as you were saving money in your account, they also had a savings account for the church. And so you could put money in your account and you could put money in the savings account for the church. So the pastor of the church was there. He's not part of the savings group, but he was there at the meeting, and they gave the pastor an envelope and said, here, this is a gift from the savings group to the church. And so I think the church probably got more money than anybody else took home from that savings group. And then before they dismissed the meeting, they said, okay, we all have money. We're going to take an offering for the church. So then they took an offering and gave that to the church as well. And it just excites me to see people realize that we can give now because we have something that we can give. We also do rotating savings groups. The rotating savings groups are common in many underdeveloped countries, and the idea is you get a group of however many people. It can be 6, it can be 12. You usually don't want to go over more than about 12 with a rotating savings group. But if everybody comes, if you let's say you have 10 people in the group, and everybody comes together and they have everybody brings $5, the equivalent of $5 US. Well, then you have $50. They give that to one person in the group. That person has $50 at one time, so they can do something they couldn't do otherwise. Then the next week, they give the $50 to another person, and they rotate the payout around the group until everybody has gotten the payout one time. And it's a way of saving. It's also, it's a way, well, the person who gets the first payout actually has borrowed $50 because they have the next 9 meetings, they have to put their $5 in and pay back what they got. The person who gets the last payout has saved. And it's very popular, but it also, the complication is you have to make sure you have people that are going to show up at all 10 meetings and put their $5 in. So one of the things that happens in these groups is when they're forming, like normally for our groups, it takes them about 3 months to get to the place where they're ready to put any money on the table, because there's a lot of things to decide. They have to write policies to decide what they're going to do if something goes wrong. So in these rotating groups, for example, they would have to decide, what are we going to do if somebody comes to the meeting and says, I don't have the $5? What happens? That has to be decided in advance before you ever start. And so that's predetermined. But the other thing is, everybody who applies to be a part of the group, everybody has to agree to be in the group with everybody else who's in the group. So if I want to be part of the group, but Hans says, you know, I don't really trust that Merle's going to bring $5. I don't really want to be in a group with Merle. Well, then I'm out. And I can't be in the group. And because they know who's reliable. And when you get in a group like that, you realize, if I don't bring my $5 one week, I'll never be in another group. And so the pressure's on to be consistent and actually have it be done. A lot of people who are in the rotating groups use the money then to buy an animal or fix up their house or those kinds of things. Then we do accumulating savings groups, and these are the groups that make loans to each other. They create a loan pool where they loan out money to each other, and they charge. Normally, these groups charge interest. They get to decide whether they're going to charge interest and how much interest they're going to charge. And in Haiti, most of the groups charge 3% a month interest on the loans that they give to each other, which is really pretty good because the loan sharks charge way more than that. And so in Kenya, they're charging 10% a month. Most of their loans are one-month loans, very small amounts. And in Kenya, they like to have all their money loaned out. They don't want to be holding money between group meetings. They try to loan everything out at the end of the meeting, and then in 1 month, it's coming back. So they're doing things like, there was a couple that had a restaurant, and they had been buying beans like pretty much every day to run their restaurant. Then they got like a $9 loan, and they could go buy a bag of beans at a lower price than what they were paying, and it lasted them a little longer. Well, they turned that bag of beans around quickly and could pay back their loan. So that's the kind of thing that's happening in the accumulating savings groups. Again, in these groups, all the loans have to be paid back at the end of the 6-month cycle, because at the end of every 6 months, there's a meeting where all the money is brought to the meeting and everybody gets their cash back they have it in their hands. So there can't be any fraud that goes on for more than 6 months. So the treasurer can't start thinking, I'm going to borrow some of that money and I'll have time to pay it back, because he doesn't. In 6 months or less, he's going to have all the money in cash at the meeting and people get it back in their hands. So we've had savings groups where people said, yeah, we'll do this, but we're going to lose money. And we even had a group where the people were kind of saving, and they're, it's okay, but you know, we know that at the end of the cycle, all that money's not going to come back. But it's still probably a good idea. Well, even at the meeting where the money was going to be distributed, there were people who came to that meeting and said, there's not going to be money here today. They'll have some story about what happened. And then they got their money back, and they're like, well, this works. And then we're going to get really serious about saving. And so they kicked their savings up to a whole new level, because it actually worked. In India, the people in India are saying, there's two things that are really making the program grow in India. One of those things is that it's designed for the church. In many of the government programs in India, you have to declare yourself to be Hindu to participate in the government programs in that particular state. So first of all, you can do it as a Christian. It's designed for Christian people. Secondly, the people say there's no corruption. And in India, where corruption is prevalent at every level of society, to have a program where all the money is there every time is just phenomenal. And so the people say because there's no corruption, it's the credibility of the program just really grows. So where are we working? We're working in Haiti. We started there in we started in the fall of 2009. Our first group started saving money about 2 weeks before the earthquake in January of 2010. And then there was a pause for a month or two, and then we got started again. So actually it was 2010 before we had people saving money. So our program there is about a little over 4 years old. We have about 4,200 people in savings groups in Haiti. In 2013, those people say, we had 3,000 people at the beginning of 2013. We had 4,000 people at the end of 2013. Those people saved the equivalent of $242,000 in 2013. I just got the report last week from March. So, and in January, February, March, in the first quarter of 2014, we had 4,200 people in savings groups. They've saved $99,000 U.S. already in the first 3 months of 2014. So they're on track to save about $400,000 in 2014. Plus, we're hoping to add people to the program. So when you go to Haiti, look around, you wouldn't think there's $400,000 kind of floating around there to be saved, but there is. And many of the people in the program have said, some of them, their incomes have gone up, but some of them said, it's not so much that our incomes have gone up, but what we do with what we have. And people say, I used to just eat my money. It would just go through my hands, and I didn't think I had anything left, so I'd buy candy and snacks and because it wasn't enough to do anything anyway. Now I put it in the savings group, and I didn't realize how much that adds up to in a year's time. And so the power of small things. Here's some people I thought you would know. This is our office in Haiti, and Joe is there. Lyndon Swory has been our, he's been with the program in Haiti since it started in 2009. And so Joe will kind of be stepping in to see what he does. Here's some more people you know in the office there. We also are working in Vijayawada, India. We started there in 2011. We have 10 Indian staff there. By the end of 2013, we had 32,000, or by the end of March this year, we had 32,500 people in savings groups in India. Like I was saying, it's just phenomenal what's happened in India. And Lanka Das from AE Mission there in Vijayawada, he's saying, this is the first thing I've ever done where people are calling me saying, will you come and do this? And what's happening in India is as the groups got started and they proved their reliability and people saw what the women in the savings groups were doing. By the way, at the end of March, there was 32,544 people in savings groups. 32,200 and some of those were women and 300 were men. So it's mostly women. And they're almost all lower caste women. And when I go into those savings groups, you get into the slums of Vijayawada and walk in there and you look at what those women are doing, it's pretty phenomenal. And we were in one of the savings groups there talking to those women and saying, why are you part of a savings group? And they said, because we're Christians and we have alcoholic husbands at home who waste their money. They don't help us at all with our families and we're really struggling. And here's a place where we can come and pray with other women and get some spiritual support, and it helps us in the hardship of our life. And what's happening for those women in the support they get from the group spiritually is as important as what's happening in the finances of the group. In this program, Lanka, if you know Lanka, he's an evangelist, and he's passionate about people coming to know the Lord, and so he's put that twist on this program. So 40% of the people in the groups are non-Christian. They're Hindu or Muslim. And what they do, they have a group that starts in a church in a village. The people in the village see the savings group and they want to be part of it. So they divide the savings group. They bring unbelievers into each savings group And they meet every week and they preach the gospel, and Hindu and Muslim people are getting saved and being baptized into the churches. And Lanka's just saying, I've never done anything that gave me more opportunities to preach the gospel, and people are asking me if they can be a part of it. I don't have to try and recruit them to come. They're just coming and calling me and saying, we want to do it. So we're grateful for what's happening there. We're also in Kenya. We have two men working there, one in Nakuru and one in Kisumu. And we started doing savings groups in the Christian Believers Fellowship churches. Now we have savings groups in all those churches, and so we're starting to reach out into some of the other churches in the area. In March of 2014, we had 23 savings groups there with 400 members, and we're hoping to probably double that this year. Teaching is a big part of it. We're developing a business curriculum to help people with business skills. We also in Haiti, this is our teacher, John Mark Phillip. We hired him to teach, and so he travels around to different groups and does teaching in their group meetings. We're working right now. We're just starting writing a booklet on family finance that will be used in the countries where we work as well. We think that real change can come through teaching and people operating successful small businesses. Our future plans, growth in the programs, we're hoping to have over 4,500 people in groups in Haiti by the end of this year. And we're introducing our first booklet in our teaching curriculum, our small business curriculum. Joe will be training the teachers to teach that booklet. It's just being published now, and we'll be in Haiti by the time Joe gets there, and so then he will be meeting with the teachers weekly or however doing that. I'm not sure how often, but I'll be training them to do the teaching of that booklet. Then we're in Haiti, in India. We're wanting to put a North American person in India. We haven't had a North American person in India up to this time, but we really need somebody there just to help with reporting and accountability. We want to see the participants use their money that they've saved to start small businesses and increase their income and their giving. In Kenya, we want to see the program grow as well. We want to add 30 new groups this year, and we're planning to have Joe revise the business curriculum booklet so that we can teach it in Kenya as well. We're also planning to start a new program in Hyderabad, India, in partnership with Good Life Ministries and Sam Gunty. That's scheduled to start. We have June 30 to July 4. We're going to be hiring staff and training staff there in Hyderabad. Sam is saying that he'll have 5,000 people in savings groups in the first year. So I'm not sure what will happen, but we'll see what God does with the program in Hyderabad. And if Joes would live in India, they would live in Hyderabad and then travel to between the programs in Hyderabad and Vijayawada, and then also to Kenya to supervise the program there. We're also talking to the churches in Guatemala that are associated with Mennonite Air Missions about starting a program there. Lyndon and I were there in April and did a feasibility study, a presentation in some of the churches, and there's a business plan in process for a program in Guatemala, perhaps to start early in 2015, but that hasn't been finalized yet. We're also talking about developing a program in Mexico. Also last month, we did a presentation in Mexico with Destinations International, and we're working with DNI, and I'm not sure where that's going to go, but there's also potential for a program in Mexico as well. We need your prayer support. It's challenging. There's lots to be done. I really believe that Open Hands is something that God is blessing, and we've been blessed with good people and with the financial support that we've needed, we're just grateful for that. And I just appreciate, especially with your connection with Joe's and Marilyn here, I just ask you to pray for them. It's a challenge to be in a setting in India or Kenya, and we really want to be sensitive to what God wants to do, and that we're doing things the way God wants them to be done, and that it's God-honoring and Christ-centered. We never want to lose that focus, and so we need your prayer support. We do need finances as well for the program. Open Hands doesn't get any direct funding from Anabaptist Financial, so all the funding that is provided, all funding that Open Hands has comes from donors that are interested in the work of Open Hands. So we do need financial support to carry on the programs. Our expenses, while we're not giving the people anything, our expenses are, we do pay the national employees, we pay their salaries, we pay their travel to visit the savings groups, we're providing the teaching material without cost to them, and of course we have our people that are doing the reporting and monitoring of the program. So those are our costs that are associated with the program. Our goal, and the goal in the field of savings groups, is that the people should be saving $4 for every dollar that you're spending on the program. We're not quite there yet. Our budget for I just have our budget here for Hyderabad is $113,000. Our Haiti budget is about the same. And this year, we'll probably get close to the 4-to-1 ratio. So if they save $400,000 this year, we're probably going to spend about $110,000. And so when you think about that, if we were to give away $100,000 in Haiti, that would be $100,000 that would be infused into the communities and they could use in whatever way they chose to use it. If we put $100,000 into the community and that results in $400,000 being used in the community, that's a pretty good return. And then in addition to the $400,000 they'll save, like last year they saved $242,000, but in addition to that, they made loans to each other of about $70,000 U.S. that were paid back. So that's money that was out there and was working in the community, helped people to increase their incomes, and then came back to the savings groups. So in addition to the $242,000 they saved, there was a $70,000 that went out in loans. The other thing is people say to us, well, do they have problems getting loan repayments? And I was in a group one time, I asked the group, so what do you do if somebody comes to the group and they don't have their money to make their loan repayment? And they said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, just that. You come to the meeting and a person's supposed to pay back $10 on their loan and they say they don't have it. What do you do? And they said, well, that never happens. And okay, good. That's what I wanted to know. But in the 4 years that we've been operating in Haiti, we have had no loans that the group didn't get the money back eventually. We had people who didn't pay it back on time, but we haven't had any loans that the money never came back to the group. We had one loan where a man got a loan. He went to the Dominican Republic before he paid back the loan. And it wasn't our problem, right? Because it's not our money. So the groups run themselves. So the group went to the man's family and said, your brother owes us money, and you're going to get it from him for us. And they did. And they got the money back. I would have never been, if it would have been our money, I'd have never seen that again. It wouldn't have come back. They just said, he's gone. We can't do anything about it. I'm sorry. But when it's their money, it came back. We had another group where a lady died before she finished paying back her loan. But she had savings in the group, and they used her savings to cover part of her unpaid balance. And then they all agreed that the interest money that they had collected by making loans, they'd use some of that to cover the difference. And so the group did it that way. Anyway, staffing, we're looking for a person. We have Joe and Marilyn going to India and doing India and Kenya. We are looking, we're starting, if we start a program in Mexico and a program in Guatemala, we really need somebody on this side of the globe to help with supervision of those programs. And so I'm looking for preferably a single man, and it'd be somebody who spoke Spanish. That'd be phenomenal. And so if you know of anybody that ought to be doing this, let them know and let me know. I'll call anybody once at least. But we would really benefit from having another North American person to provide some accountability and supervision for our programs here in Haiti, and if we have a program in Guatemala and Mexico and other Spanish-speaking countries in Central and South America. So appreciate your interest this afternoon and your support for Joe and Marilyn, and they're joining the team. We're excited about having them on board, and I just am excited about what God can do through them. Joe's schooling and just his experience is just a perfect fit for what we do, and so I'm very pleased to have them joining the team. Do you have any questions? Anything? That's kind of a quick overview, but are there things that you'd like to, a question that you had that you'd just like to know a little more about. Yes. We are in the southern, about halfway out the southern peninsula. We're in the Miraguan area of Haiti. So most of our groups would be within about a 2 or 3 hour circle of Miraguan. Yeah. Yes?
I'm just curious what you do if someone comes to you that isn't really eligible for a savings group, like someone who really doesn't make enough to support himself. How do you handle that? Do you have other groups you can refer that person to? Or?
We will put that person into a direct savings group where they can save what they can. So the people who are in the direct savings groups, they don't have to save a certain amount every week. So a person can be in a direct savings group and save very, very little, but they can benefit from the teaching, and they can start to learn and move toward where they can do something. So we feel like even if people can't save very much, they can benefit from the teaching. So we would bring those people into a direct savings group, and they may be able to only save 4 or 5 times in a 6-month cycle, but that's a little bit, and they get the teaching in the meantime. But what we do works really well. Even if you have people who can only save 10 cents every 2 weeks, you have to start somewhere. And what we do really works best with people who aren't really at the point for microfinance. They're not really ready for it. Loaning them money could be the worst thing you do to them because they don't have the experience to be able to pay back a loan. And so you're better off to get them into a savings group, and what they have is an asset rather than a liability, and it helps them to get started.
Do you have people who graduate from the group in the sense that they feel like they can save by themselves and be independent?
People who graduate out of the groups usually get to a point where they have a big enough business that they move on to a microfinance organization, and they can, like most, our average loan in Haiti is about $60 US. In Kenya, the average loan is more like $12. But what happens, people who graduate out of the group, they get to the place where they need a $300 loan or a $500 loan, and then they go to microfinance organizations, and then they move on to or they can get into the regular banking system, and they kind of graduate out of it that way. But I don't know. It's an interesting question. I don't know if there. I don't know of people who said, "Well, I learned to do. I learned the discipline in the savings group. I'll do it at my house without the group." Most of them, they enjoy what the benefits they get from the group that they continue on. We have groups that in Haiti now that are 4 years old that they've gone through. I mean, they've done it for so long that if our organization didn't exist, they'd just keep right on saving because they know what they're doing. And we visit those groups maybe twice a year, and they're pretty much self-operating.
Where do you keep the money? Like you said, that they are about 3 hours away from the bank. Do you have like provide space for them, or where do they keep the money?
Yeah, every group has to decide what they're going to do with their money. So groups that are close to a bank often take it to the bank. Groups that are far away from bank, like that group that I showed you a picture of that was 3 hours from a bank, they have a wooden box, and they have three padlocks. The back side has hinges. The other three sides have a padlock, and all the padlocks have a different key, and then three group members have one of the keys, so all three of them have to be present in order to open the box. And some of the groups, they shuffle the keys and pass them out to different groups, so not the same group members are taking keys home every week. And nobody knows who has the key to which padlock because they've shuffled them all. And so they're pretty ingenious for security. What they do worry about is everybody knows who the treasurer is and that wooden box is in their house. And obviously you could take an axe and break it open and steal the money. But what you have to remember is 20 people contributed money, had money in that box. It's one thing if I'm a fairly wealthy person living in the community and you break into my house and steal my money, but if you steal that box, you just rob 20 families in your community. You're not going to be able to live there anymore. So that's the security they have. And so far, we haven't had any boxes stolen, but it really, if a person would do that, they would have to move away because everybody would be so angry with them. They probably wouldn't survive. So, yeah. Yes.
What is your take about taking money down there to build houses for the people? You say we don't give. There we do.
Yeah, let me clarify. There are three kinds of things three categories. One is relief, and there's a place for relief. And there are times when there's earthquakes, tornadoes, where people just, they need a place to live. And you know, we need to do that. And Jesus said, if someone's hungry, feed them. And it really, there is a place for that. But when relief becomes an ongoing, perpetuated system for decades, it's detrimental. But that shouldn't keep us from ever doing relief. Then there's rehabilitation, where something disrupted the system and people have skills and there are some physical assets there, but it doesn't match up. And you help people to put the pieces back together and create a working system. I was in Myanmar in 2011, and Cyclone Nargis had come through there. We were down in the Irrawaddy Delta. We were on an island that had 10 villages, and the village that we were in before the storm had a population of 1,000. When we were there 2 years later, it had a population of 250 because three quarters of the people died. And most of them died because the government wouldn't allow aid agencies to come into the community to provide relief because they were tribal people and the government wanted them to die, and they did. And so now in that community, their industry was raising shrimp and crab, and they had land where they had raised shrimp. And there were young men there who their grandfathers were shrimp farmers. They knew how to raise shrimp, but they didn't have any land. And there were widow ladies who had land, but weren't shrimp farmers. And so we were able, through the church, to help to bring some funds there to buy land so the young men in the church who knew how to raise shrimp could buy the land from the widow ladies and they could raise shrimp. So it just took a one-time thing to get the pieces together. So now there's 10 families in that community that are raising shrimp and they're on their way. And what they did then is they said 40% of the money that they got will go to for income for the families that are raising the shrimp. 40% goes to pay back the investors who put money into the program, and 20% goes to the church to help other men buy land to raise shrimp. So it's a perpetuating system. And so that's rehabilitation. Then there's development, where the skills aren't there and you really have to help create a working system where people can. But there's definitely a place for relief. And we're not a relief organization, but there are relief organizations and they're great organizations, and there's definitely a place for that. Yeah.
For the 242,080 in perspective, what is an average annual income?
According to the World Bank figures, in 2012, the average annual wage in Haiti was $760, I think, something like it was $700 a year. So, yeah. Anything else? All right, I'd like for Joe to make some comments from his perspective. So, Joe.
Thanks a lot, Merle, for taking the time to come out here, and very good presentation, great message as well. And I'm very excited about the opportunity to work with Open Hands. Thanks to Marvin for kind of putting the idea there for us, and he was getting ready to kick me out of Golden Rule Property Management, so this was a great exit for him. No, we've had good times working in property management together, and looking forward to good times working together in Open Hands as well. I'm very, very happy for how God has led our family. I've been praying for years for God to lead and guide us to cross-cultural ministry and kind of to design something that would be a fit for us. And so just praising God for being faithful in leading us to this. Seems like something that'll be a lot of fun, very fulfilling. And it's one thing about Open Hands that I think is neat. A lot of times I've kind of heard that at first people don't seem to be that excited about it. People in the savings groups, they think, okay, and Merle kind of describes some of that. But then after a while, once they see this really works, then they really get excited about it. I think that includes hosting missions and pastors as well. So it's a system that is making a difference. It works. And so it's neat to see how God is working through Open Hands. And we are very excited to be able to be a part of that. Thanks to each one of you for coming out on a Sunday afternoon and sacrificing some of your Sunday afternoon nap for this. That means a lot to us. And I hope that the time here has been worthwhile for you. I hope that you'll remember to pray for Open Hands, pray for our family. There will be some challenges, of course, living cross-culturally. Also, some exciting things about living cross-culturally. Growing up in a foreign country, I tend to love living in foreign cultures, so it's a pretty cool opportunity. I guess let's close with prayer. Y'all can stand and we'll pray. Father God, thank you so much for today. Thank you for each person here. Thank you for their interest in the poor in foreign countries. And Father, thank you so much for Open Hands. Thank you for the way you're working through Open Hands. We just pray that you continue to bless the work, bless the people in the savings programs. Pray that you could get a lot of glory from this, and that people could continue to become givers, and that your kingdom could grow a lot through this program, and that people would come to you. And so just bless each one here. Bless them for coming out today. And thank you for blessing each one of us, and pray that we could be a blessing to others. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.